is the One Ocean Hub podcast.
Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of the One Ocean Hub podcast, our ongoing conversation about the interrelationship of the ocean and the humankind. And within this layered and complex and often complicated interrelationship of the ocean and the humankind, among the central actors are islands, these land masses surrounded by water, each discrete and unique and peculiar in their cultures, communities, customs, plant and animal species, each, in other words, with their own environmental and societal endemisms, all connected by our one ocean and all sharing the vulnerabilities and the threats looming over our ocean. My name is Milica Prokic and I am a knowledge exchange associate at the One Ocean Hub. I'm an environmental historian and an island enthusiast. And I'm joined today by the two One Ocean Hub researchers and island women, both of whom are bound to islands in their work and their lives. We're here with Lisa Winnie from the Solomon Islands and Alana Lancaster tuning in today from Barbados. Hello, Lisa and Alana. It's my immense pleasure to talk to you today.
Hello, and it's nice to be here today.
Hi, Milica and Lisa. Thank you for having me.
So Lisa, you are, as I said, a One Ocean Hub researcher, and you're doing your PhD at the moment, and you're doing it at the Strathclyde Centre for Environmental Law and Governance here with us in Glasgow. And as I said, you come from Solomon Islands, which is a fascinating country. It's a fascinating place in space. It's a collective territory of about 900 islands that are spread across a vast expanse of the ocean. And we're going to talk about it in just a second. And Alana, you live and teach in Barbados, where you are a lecturer in law, and you're head of the Environmental Law, Ocean Governance and Climate Justice Unit at University of West Indies, right? So the context in which the three of us are talking today, I think, is quite interesting. There's a mishmash of positionalities. The 98% of its expanse is actually the ocean, while only 2% is land. So you come from Solomon Islands. And Alana, you come from Guyana, which is Central American mainland, but also very much a coastal place.
With one coast. it has both of the properties, I suppose, of an island and landlocked, because 75% of the country is on the primary forest. But that would be away from the coast. And about 1/7 of the country is the coastline.
Yeah. And then the place where you now reside for the most part and where you work and where you teach is Barbados, which is the island nation.
Large ocean state, if you want, because it's not as extreme as where Lisa is from, but it's marine exclusive economic zone is, I believe, 388 times its land size. So it's 166 square kilometers.
Mm. Lisa, you're in the writing up phase of your PhD, which is a beautiful and daunting phase of that work. And your research is delving into the history of the Solomons and the interactions of the colonial legacy with the local customs and the policies that that govern or try to govern Solomons to this day. And your research draws from the multiple conversations with the local community, with the community that you come from on the Solomons. So could you tell us what inspired your research? How do these policies of today interact with the colonial past of the Solomons?
Well, I just started off with the issue that I realized we're not bringing the local realities into decision-making processes that we're doing at the national level. That's what started this off. And I wanted to know more about who I am, what my history is, reconnecting to place, because I think a bigger part of it as well is I've been slowly disconnecting myself from that reality as well by engaging in processes that are very Western. I don't want to use Western, but I think because it's more about our education system as well. It's building us and preparing us to work in places that are not back in the village.
what I understand when people say Western in the context that you perhaps said this now, is the reality where even now, today, after the colonial period and after the independence was won, there is still an imposition of the Anglophone post-Enlightenment academic ex-cathedra knowledge and the way of thinking that is not embedded or embodied at all in the way that the Solomon Islands are, because it comes from outside of the island world and outside of Solomon's. It comes from a metropolis somewhere, right? And that somewhere isn't on the global south. And based on that knowledge that is quite disembodied from the island world, the policies are made, policies that disregard the knowledge and the way of life and the needs of people that they are supposed to serve, the people who live on and with these islands, right?
The outcome of that is having policies that sit on the bench and just collect dust. Because it can, even if it's tried to be implemented, you don't get the impact you want. And this has been acknowledged a lot, but there's not a conversation on why is it not working. And as a person from place, it's just from the start, you can see that won't work because you're approaching it in a way that doesn't make sense to the people.
Well, from the Caribbean perspective, I can say it's not only does it make sense to the people, we tend to, because a lot of our work that contributes to policy, be it either through actual policy or law or implementation, comes through funding, much of which is tied. So it comes through grant funding, whatever have you, which had several issues attached to it. Some funders actively, they don't really say it, but it's implicit that you need to include persons from, EU projects, for example, some firm from the EU. So the work is usually led by some firm from the EU who might have done the work because they fail to have done it in a third world country, as they like to put it. When I was at the agency, they feel like all third world countries are the same. So they did it in Africa. So it must, they come with this preconceived package notion. So sometimes you get beautiful laws, beautiful policies, or implementation measure that has not really taken into consideration the culture, the people, the traditional knowledge and the system. So where I'm from, Guyana, for many years, indigenous people, and to some extent, are still looked at as less knowledgeable. So when I was growing up, there's a word that it's now illegal, but when you say it, it meant that you were stupid, and it was the pejorative term for indigenous people in our country, because the thought was, you know, you're from the interior, the bushes, we say, you don't know about, you know, Western things. And again, you know, even though we got independence, colonization still really permeates. And so often when you have these mechanisms, so let's say it's a fisheries law, you know, yes, we don't want XYZ to be overfished. It's overfished, yes. Have we found out why it's overfished? Is it a traditional or local delicacy? How have they managed this in past times that they can use it as a delicacy and not overfish it? What are the threats? You know, these are, and then, you know, especially for environmental and ocean issues, I always say that, yes, laws are important, a regulatory and governance framework is important, but it's not necessarily always the most effective way.
Mm-hmm. So, and the local demand as well. Sorry to jump in here. I just wanted to sort of reflect on a couple of things in sort of showing us a bit of a tapestry. And you are, as you said, from Guyana originally, but you live in Barbados, right?
Yeah, I live and work in Barbados. And I mean, the university where I am at actually serves 16 of the states in the Caribbean region, which are mostly island states. So with the exception of Guyana and, well, Guyana is not a contributing country, but Belize is, which is on the Central American mainland.
Yeah, no, that would be like sort of like my next segue into conversation as we sort of navigate through these complex relationships. Because you opened up a couple of things. You opened this sort of like mainland adjacent versus island, and this very sort of oceanic space and way of living, and the way that that's absolutely permeated for generations and thousands of years, people's diets, people's way of being, people's way of knowing, local people's way of knowing stuff. And then you also mentioned, as you were talking about this like imposing of Western knowledge and the way that that the funding, research funding is distributed and conceptualized, where there has to be somebody coming from the global north or from the west or what have you, who has to sort of be written in the grant in order for the local researchers to even access the funds. What you describe is almost the process of recolonizing or reassertion of the colonial relationships.
By post-independence governments, yes.
Yes, exactly. And I was wondering whether both of you can speak a little bit about that. In the vast expanses of coastal, island, and oceanic spaces, how does this concept of borders even work out, especially those borders imposed by the colonial slicing and dividing of the dominions? This very terrestrial notion that's again, very unlike this archipelagic world, and it seems quite unfitting to those who are used to navigate the waters between these vast expanses, between the islands. Do these lines make any sense to local people at all, do you reckon?
Considering that that those lines are limitations, imaginary lines, and probably if we look at the connections of the people pre-colonization.
That's the other interesting thing too, when you look at, and it's very clear in terms, well, I suppose clearer in terms of indigenous people, because even though they might be in different states logistically now, there are many similarities. They belong to tribes that are, you know, cross borders. So they, especially in the South American mainland, at least that's what I'm more familiar with. So you have certain tribes which may be in Guyana, but they are closely related to other tribes found in Brazil or Venezuela and so on, and they can be very fluid, some of them. And then within the Caribbean basin of itself, because most of the inhabitants of the Caribbean basin would have been transplanted here during the transatlantic slave trade, as well as to some extent indentureship which followed, there's an interest, and I like to say that we might be unique islands or states, but there's some similarities, and the differences are just amazing, because, you know, we have similar sayings, similar traditions in foods. It might look different or the components may be different, but the bottom line is it's, you know, very much the same. So, you know, it's quite interesting to unpack from that perspective, but also very challenging.
You're talking about multiple insularities, but also multiple connections. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for sort of illuminating, giving us a glimpse of that in the Caribbean context. And indeed, the reason why I'm really excited to talk to you two today is because there is a notion that has been noted by Peter Conrad, who's a literary scholar, but he's very interested in islands. And he comes from one. He was born in Tasmania. He said something along the lines of everyone is related to an island, whether by birth or whether the island that they're assigned later in life. We are all connected to an island somehow, and islands are interconnected by the waters and by the connections. Yes. People, right? And the food and the custom and everything from the dress to the music, and it pops out everywhere, and the way of knowing, the way of sailing, the way of cooking, the way of venerating the way of worship, the few of many, many, many. Lisa, can you illuminate a little bit for us these pre-colonial connections in the Pacific context and maybe in the particular context of the Solomon Islands?
So interestingly, when we speak about islands, I just recently learned from my stories with people in Solomons that we do not see islands. We see places and we see people. So what normally everyone would see as a landmass with water around it, that's not what we conceptualize as an island and how we relate to each other. What we see is the place that you're inhabiting, the state that is created as the Solomon Islands is made up of over 1,000 islands. History books say 999 islands. So it's an archipelagic state. That construction is based on an external perspective. What I have recently come across in conversations with my fellow people in the islands is that we do not see islands. How it was constructed was, okay, this region of islands, they look the same, they have the same color skin, they'll be one region. To us, it's not like that. It's about places. It may be this part of the island and it's connected to another part of another island because the people are connected through their worshiping probably to the same God, which may be a shark, which may be a crocodile, which may be another spiritual being. It can be through their similar practices. It can be through their agreement on how to connect and relate to each other and how they will protect each other as they coexist. So it could be like three different places on three different islands. And that's one people. And you could see that as I follow it, it was more than like 26 these kinds of connection that exists. But then coming back to where I come from, it's actually a lagoon with people building their own islands to live on. And they are again similarly connected to a god that they all worship together. They practice and agree on the same way of living, which is passed through from that god that they worship. And it's about their surrounding as well. They're fishing people, they live off the sea, they trade with the people on the land, and that distinguishes them as an island group.
Right. What's the name of that island group? What's the term for the people of the sea in your language?
Okay, so the lagoon itself is called Lau Lagoon, and the people inhabiting the lagoon are called the Asi people. Asi means the sea. So in our dialect, it's Imola Yasi. Imola is people. Imola Yasi, people of the sea.
As opposed to people from the land who are called something else.
Yes, so the people of the land are called the Tolo people, meaning they're from the land, highlands, bush. And with colonialism, it has been negatively thought of as backward, non-progressive.
Oh, wow. it's basically like in Guyana. I remember I was telling you about the pejorative term for...
Yeah, you got me excited. I was,
wow. Yeah. Yeah. And interesting because also we have tribes that you associate with the coast and many of them have relatives in the islands of the Caribbean, whereas we have nine tribes, three of which are associated with the coast. The other six are termed mainland, I suppose, would be people, and their associations are with the Amazon basin. So the Brazil, Venezuela, Suriname, French Guiana, and so on. So it's very interesting similarities. Intriguing, actually.
Yeah, yes. And probably because the people of the sea, when we have interaction with traders and explorers, that they were more exposed to the visitors, that they term more progressive. And the people in the on the land did not want to have anything to do with the visitors, and so they were termed as backward. But now thinking about it, I think it's all about them wanting to protect who they are.
Yeah, but it also sort of goes against the that very entrenched notion of to be insular is to, or like to be of an island is to be out of touch. What you seem to be describing each in your context is the hyper connection and the multiple ways that the islanders are connected to the world around them. And I guess that also transpires to the way that they navigate the waters between their islands. I wanted to really ask you to share with us, which to great extent both of you already have, being somebody who lives or who hails from an island and being a researcher of that island, what are the main topics that you engage with each in your work and each in your research? Because both of you are doing work that's based in sort of an academic institution. Both of you are researchers, and both of you also have done and still do work out with that context. So maybe starting with you, Alana, can you tell us, so you are a lawyer.
And what okay, you- so maybe I should give a bit of context in my background and then to get to, I suppose, where I am now, which I guess to some extent influences my research and some of, you know, where I see women researchers. So while I suppose I've been categorized as a lawyer now, I actually began my life in environmental science and geography, because in secondary school we have this thing called streaming. So I was streamed to the science field, but I love traveling and geography. So when I went to university, that's where I combined it. And this, so eventually I then got an opportunity to go to the Dominican Republic, and I worked in environmental and natural resource management for quite a few years. And I specialized in marine protected areas, well, management. And then I suppose that naturally led to the next role in life, which I think is what she kind of brought me to the law. So I eventually became the director of the Environmental Management Division of the Environmental Protection Agency of Guyana. This role, many responsibilities, but three key aspects of my portfolio, which I think led me to do law and now features in the work that I do, is environmental impact assessments, which is closely also linked to planning, as well as coastal zone management. And as director, I was also a focal point for many regional as well as multilateral agreements. And basically, all three of these areas are characterized by the fact that they're underpinned by either international or national law and policy. And that's how essentially I decided, okay, I'm going to do law. So I view myself basically as, I suppose, a legal with, I would say, interdisciplinary tendencies. Well, you know, of looking at issues, and because I think my one love is really the ocean and the sea.
We're going to get in a minute into not just your trajectory to how you developed your inter and multidisciplinary career indeed, but also some major landmarks that happened relatively recently and throughout. So like definitely a prolific scholar spanning and straddling disciplines. And I think that I had the major contribution to inter-American court, for example, just last week, but to name but one, but we'll get to it in a second. But I think that the question that I wanted to sort of ask you answered itself. You come from a coastal place and you work in you work on an island. Has shaped your interest, your research interest, we could safely say, to a great deal, right?
Yeah.
And Lisa, yes, in a similar vein, you're also an interdisciplinarian in the way that your trajectory to academia wasn't quite direct. It actually came from working and doing in the community and working on sort of reshaping the decision-making processes. Could you tell us a little bit more about your trajectory?
It was a struggle for me to come into this space of research because basically of the negative connotations back home as well. Research is seen as an external person coming in to take knowledge. And so for me coming into this space, there are things I need to clarify to also build relationships so that my own people do not see me as someone who just want to elevate myself. I think that was the critical thing about my shift into research. But to be really clear that this is about me understanding better who we are so that I could be of service for my people better. So a lot of how I approach my work is based on that. How do I not make people feel less than who they are? How do I address the mistrust that I'm doing this just for myself? And then engaging with my family a lot. They are the support system that also helps me in my optics within the community. So they advise me on how do I converse, who do I converse with, who do I not converse with at that time. And it's also timing. When do I start talking with certain uncles? When do I not talk with certain uncles? And them understanding the deep politics and the social intricacies within our place, I'm able to navigate the community space, and I'm able to navigate also the space at the state level. But it's about the entire process as well as being very humbling, because you're always careful to ensure that you're respectful to really bring out that it's not about you, it's about getting the voices of the underrepresented onto the table.
Right. So your venturing into the world of research, or like institutionalized research, what we call academia, has been a thoroughly transformative process for you from within as well. You mentioned two things that I really don't want to miss at all. One of them is this knowledge extraction. So if I understand correctly, in the community that you research about and that you research with for your PhD thesis, there's an entrenched notion that whoever comes from this academic context is somebody who's coming to take, to extract. And I think that in the colonial or post-colonial, if we can even call it post-colonial, because we were talking a little bit about colonialization through different processes, including the knowledge extraction and imposing certain knowledges upon the local communities. So you flag this knowledge extraction and the negative impact that it has and it has had on the community. So I would like, if you can, if you could tell us a little bit about these consequences of knowledge extraction in Solomon Islands in particular. That would be my first question. And the second question is like, can you just tell us about what's the crux of your research? What do you research for your PhD?
Yes. So the consequences of this is we come from a collective society. So when people see you like you're very individualistic, then a lot of the things that comes with being a collective society, I think we need to put into context that the places that I come from are communal, to the point where there are practices, there are ways of engaging, there are relationships that are important, and there are ways to maintain those relationships as well. And when someone feels like you're just using them to elevate yourself, it doesn't go well. And it's probably the spiritual gods will deal with you, but you won't have a full life that comes with the blessing of being in that community.
Yeah, so it's the community that sort of that is defensive from the extraction of knowledge, from sort of and it's really interesting that you say that it's very defensive of individualism, which is a big emblem of liberal capitalism and of this mechanisms that drive neocolonialism. So your PhD research, it came from the work that you did pre-PhD. And then tell us about the theme of your PhD.
Okay. So my research came about when I was doing legislative review for ocean planning. And when we did the review, I was part of the process. And I saw that we only looked at the statutory laws. And I wondered, what about the laws in the communities where I come from? And someone said to me, it is not law, because it is not written. And I was shocked, because does that mean my people don't exist? That the entire reality that I am brought up in does not exist? And I was really surprised. I couldn't accept that. And so my research is about, I started wanting to know, what is law? And which law is the law that should be regulating us? And so that's where I'm interested in history, colonial history. I'm looking at where laws came out, where the laws we have come out from. Is it from us? Where is it coming from?
Mm. And Alana, I know from the many conversations where you and I have nerded out about history, that you, in your legal and your scholarly work and your research and your advocacy work, as well as in your understanding of your place, of the Caribbean, that your views and your work and thinking are often informed by the lessons from history, right?
When I studied environmental science and geography, because we don't teach it and I don't think we cherish our traditional and indigenous knowledge, we don't pay enough attention to the role history plays in a lot of what we're discussing here. Oceans, how people are positioned, how people interact, how their rights are either protected or not safeguarded. And my dad would always say, if you don't know your history, you don't know where you're going. And I often, I think, so for example, when I participate in the Hub's customary law group, it's super interesting for me, because a lot of the things that I remember him telling me, as, you know, you tell me a story, a lot of this stuff, you know, about, you know, transatlantic slave trade and how the Caribbean developed in its early days, the Haitian Revolution and so on. I see a lot of this now when I look at fisheries law, dare I say, because most of the law I was trained in is from a top-down approach and from a hugely Western, you know, international law, from a Western, with Western principles.
Yeah, and that really speaks to your doctoral research, Lisa, doesn't it? You're kind of trying to trace back the custom in the Solomons, and you're trying to make it emerge from under the layers of statutory law, right?
So my work is, I've come across seeing as well that laws are built from fundamental values, and fundamental values of my people differs from the fundamental values of where my statutory laws come out from, especially the ones we have inherited. So this is something interesting, because I feel that I think the way my people have been seeing things is what we need for humanity to thrive.
Okay, so that's a perfect segue to my next question that I'm really excited now to pose to you, maybe get Alana's opinion afterwards as well. Recently I heard you assert something that's quite brilliant in my opinion, and that's that inter and transdisciplinary research, as we understand it now, is actually indigenous and local wisdom and knowledge. And this is something that seems to have come out of your research. And why do you assert what you assert?
So I'm a marine scientist by training. And my mother, if I go to work, she has absolutely no idea what I'm doing. And she would ask, for 5 years, she would ask, what am I doing? And explained, and she couldn't get it. Until now that I'm working on bringing in people's knowledge into policy, and she goes, ah, I understand what you're doing, because she sees herself in that, which is a holistic way of seeing the ocean, a holistic way that it's not about just the organisms in the sea. It's about, yes, life in the sea, the atmosphere around us that regulates the space. It's the people within, and this entire system, one is not superior than the other. And it is through this lens that I say, because my mother knows that, and it has been passed down through her mother. And that's why I'm saying it's been there since my ancestors, to see things in a holistic way, to not see boundaries or imaginary lines, and to fear imaginary lines.
These holistic ways of knowing, local, embedded, and embodied knowing, trans and intergenerational, and across the communities, is actually much, much older than this quote-unquote Western, or like post-Enlightenment Western knowledge that has ruled the waves for a very long time. But yeah, that's brilliant. And thank you so much for this answer. Alana, do you have any thoughts on this?
From my perspective, when it comes to issues of environmental, natural resources, these are areas which historically, in colonial times and in post-colonial governments, we seek to regulate primarily by legislation. But because of the nature of these goods, their transboundary effects, which happen very far, can impact anyone's state. And at a very local level, these resources are important for cultural, spiritual, economic, and other reasons. There really needs to be a different lens. And I think that one of the lenses that I found that resonates with me is, of course, the work between human or the link between human and children's rights, for example. I think in the Caribbean generally, for many years we have, I don't want to say bought or had to accept that, research, it can be, very monolithic or in silos, because there would be very procedural exercises where, they were being done because they were in law,
mm-hmm.
but the substantive issue, so the engagement, the meaningful engagement and participation of the community was not really the focus. And I think a lot of that comes from the disconnects we have between disciplines, as well as not really and truly understanding the issue, as well as excluding persons with indigenous and traditional knowledge from decision making. I'm happy that in the Caribbean, it is, while these disconnects have created less than optimal conditions, it is also through the law, which groups have been finding in a great, you know, be there community groups or civil society groups in collaboration with communities, and now we have academia and collaboration, have been finding innovative ways of making a legal and policy regime, which really isn't the most friendly toward transdisciplinarity and so on, work or kind of prodding it to work by utilizing various legal mechanisms. Also, we've had, for example, requesting that there be a hearing from the Inter-American Commission in 2021 on the role of extractives, climate change, and human rights in the environment. And these are areas in which the governments and other entities have to be responsive in some measure to this.
This is the One Ocean Hub podcast.